I hear a telephone. Yes, I hear a telephone. First of all, let's just start off with the ground rules. Everyone has telephones, any type of electronic devices, and I need you to turn them off, not just to the silent position, but to the off position. It does, in fact, interfere with the intercom system and the recording, so please do that. We have a work session, a number of bills up today, and I'm calling into order, I should say, the Senate Committee on Commerce. We have a number of bills that we have before us, some for work session, some for public hearing, and maybe some for both. What we're going to do is try to move through some of the agenda that we know that we're taking quick action on. And so I'm going to start with a work session on Senate Bill 858. And Ms. Brown, why don't you give us a quick review over that?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 858, if you remember, we heard on April 11th, that allows adult foster care providers the right to collectively bargain with the state of Oregon on the matters concerning labor relations. It prohibits striking. There is a Dash 3 amendment. The Dash 3 amendment limits the definition of adult foster care home providers to those who own their own home or have a controlling interest in or a partner or an officer in an entity that is a provider of a foster home and receives payment from the state for providing adult foster care home services. It clarifies that the state of Oregon is the employer of record for the purposes of collective bargaining and rewards the preservation of rights for the adult receiving foster care. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right, the intent of the chair on this is to do two things. One, if we have consensus to move the Dash 3 into the bill, we'll do that. At that point, we will move the bill to the Rules Committee. We are not moving this to the floor. So, committee, any questions and any desires as to how we proceed?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Beyer.
From my perspective, I don't support moving this bill anywhere. This bill, I just don't think deserves moving further, and I've got, and I'm sure you probably all have also, a couple thousand petitions signed by people who are opposed to the bill, who are in the industry, in addition to, looks like it's 75 calls received in the last, well, since Monday.
That's all?
That's all. I'm not the chair.
Yeah, I'm going to say.
So, you know, I don't see a reason why the state of Oregon would try to make employers members of a union, and the really ironic part of that would be their employees would not be. And that I find absolutely amazing, and so I will not support moving this bill anywhere personally, and I understand I'm only one.
Understand. Thank you for your comments. The chair will entertain a motion on the Dash 3 amendments, though.
May I ask a question, Mr. Chair?
You may.
As the as you stated your intent, do you know the intent of the chair of the Rules Committee? Would they be holding additional public hearings? What might we anticipate as this moves forward?
I really don't know, except the chair of that committee asked that this bill be referred there because she felt that we would not be able to get our work completed and that she thought there may be some additional work that needed to be done on the bill, and she expects that this committee will not be able to complete that work by Monday. And I would agree with her knowing what it's on our agenda for Monday.
You've answered the question. Thank you.
Yep.
Mr. Chair, I move the Dash 1 amendments into Senate Bill 853 into Senate Bill 858.
All right. Senator Avakian moves the Dash 3 amendments into Senate Bill 858. Is there any further discussion?
Just that I appreciate Senator Beyer making sure that we got the right language into that important bill. Thank you, Senator Beyer.
Is there any objection?
I object, Mr. Chair.
Please note Senator Beyer objecting to the adoption of the Dash 3s into the bill, but even with that objection, it appears that we have the votes to move that forward, and so it is ordered. Ready to have a motion that would send the bill with a due pass recommendation as amended to the Committee on Rules.
So moved, Mr. Chair.
Senator Avakian moves Senate Bill 858 as amended by the Dash 3 amendments with a due pass recommendation to be referred to the Committee on Rules. Any other discussion?
Just to reaffirm my objection to the motion, Mr. Chair.
And as Senator Byers already put on the record, that we stay on part of the record as to his objection to the bill being moved or worked at any part.
Mr. Chair?
Let's go with first Senator Gordley and then Senator Monroe.
Thank you. I support moving the bill onto rules. It's quite evident that There are several issues that need to be further explored that can be explored in the Rules Committee, where there will hopefully also be additional opportunities for public testimony. Clearly, there's a great deal of public interest in this issue, and the Rules Committee will be able to take that up.
And Senator Monroe.
Thank you. I represent a district that includes an awful lot of adult foster home and adult foster homes that are run by people of Eastern European ethnicity. They do a wonderful job by and large. They took care of my mother-in-law in her late years and my aging aunt in her late years. But I do believe that there's been a lot of misunderstanding, misinformation. I don't know if that's because of cultural differences or what. I've heard from a number of people, though, with information that they think that this bill will somehow make them a part of government, or that the union is a part of government. I've heard a number of other, false pieces of information. So there's obviously needs to be a lot more work done on this bill before and if it would ever pass. I will support moving it on to the Rules Committee, but I would hope, and I will take this to the chair, I would hope that the Rules Committee will take seriously their task, and if they decide to hold further hearings, that they will look carefully into some of the allegations that have been made, some of the false statements that have been made, and try to make sure that everybody understands exactly what this, which is essentially a piece of permissive legislation, does.
Yeah, thank you, Senator Monroe. Any other comments? Any objection except for Senator Byer? So please note Senator Byer's objection to the bill moving forward on the motion to the Rules Committee. That will be ordered. And we'll be closing the work session on Senate Bill 858. But before I do so, I want to make sure those who are supporters or opponents to this bill, the bill has now been referred to the Committee on Rules. And those who want to give additional comment and testimony should direct that attention to the committee that the bill is now being referred to. That would be the Senate Committee on Rules. And it no longer will be in our possession. With that, it is now closed the public hearing, the work session on Senate Bill 858. I will now open a public. Let me make another statement. I'm going to make another statement. We had two other bills that we thought we were going to be doing today. Because of technical difficulties, the bills are not ready to move forward. Those bills are Senate Bill 560, Senate Bill 788. If you're here for either of those bills will be carried over to this coming Monday, April 30th. So if you're here today for Senate Bill 560, Senate Bill 788, you may want to go ahead and leave unless you want to stay here and observe us while we give testimony or hear testimony on the remaining bills that are on our agenda for today. With that, I'm going to stand at ease. Why don't we go off the record for a moment? Wow. I just want to say I never saw a room quite get cleared after making an announcement, but I think that those individuals will be back on Monday, so staff may want to be ready for an active Monday with those three, well, the two of the three bills that we just disposed of for today. So with that said, it looks like we're going to go ahead and open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 504.
Why
don't you go do the thing and we'll...
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 504 adds the requirement that the attending physician be responsible on an ongoing basis for treatment of a workers' compensation injury. It has a dash 2 amendment, and that dash 2 amendment allows an emergency room physician who is not authorized to serve as an attending physician to authorize temporary disability benefits for 14 days. The dash 2 amendment is new. I think you got it today on your desk. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right, thank you. Just for clarification, do we know of the what was the popularity of which bill was people are here for this last one? I'm just curious.
No. I believe that was 858.
Okay. All righty. So we have a sign-in sheet for Senate Bill 504. It looks like we have two individuals that at this point are the ones that have signed up, Anthony Miller and John Schultz. Excuse me. Why don't we both go ahead and come on up, and Anthony, we'll let you go first, and then John will be second, and we'll see if there's anyone else who wants to give testimony on that particular bill. When you're ready.
I'm Anthony Miller. I'm here representing the Oregon Self-Insured Association. This bill actually is the germ of this was a frustration that I personally had. I deal quite a bit with workers' compensation claims with injured workers. I meet with a lot of injured workers to help them get back to work and to get the claim processed. And this came out of a frustration that I had when workers go to an emergency room, and I don't know if any of you have been to an emergency room lately. They wait for 2 hours, see a doctor for 2 minutes, and we get a report back saying, you know, take time off and go see your attending physician. And the drawback to that is two things. Is number one, you don't always get a really good true diagnosis from the emergency room physician. They're just trying to make sure the person's medically stat and move them along. And they don't always get the proper treatment. And then trying to get an emergency room doctor to sign off on a light duty to get the person back to work as soon as possible is next to impossible, just because they see the person for such a little time. They have they tend to not keep regular office hours. They work at multiple facilities, and oftentimes they just refuse because they say, I'm not the attending physician, I don't know enough about him. So the original language that we took to MLAC on this, labor liked the concept but not some of the language. So we had a work group with the department. There was labor involved. We had plaintiff attorneys involved. And we came up with the language that we currently have in this past MLAC 10-0.
Thank you. John.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm John Schultz. I'm the administrator of the Workers' Compensation Division, which is part of the Department of Consumer and Business Services. And I'm really happy to be here today to provide some information about Senate Bill 504. And Anthony did a good job, I think, in presenting information, so I'll try not to repeat what Anthony told you. But I do want to agree that when a worker seeks treatment through a hospital emergency room, and that happens a lot in terms of workers' compensation, the worker may only see the physician for that one visit. And then the claims adjusters do have difficulty later contacting the emergency room physician to clarify their return to work options, temporary disability benefits, treatment issues, and obtaining closing examinations, all things that we ask the attending physicians to do in workers' compensation. And the way the law works today is that could go on for over 30 days before administratively you could start sending what is known as a bug letter within the system to start getting that worker to a different attending physician. And that's quite a long time in workers' compensation. So the -2 amendments basically exclude emergency room physician from the definition of an attending physician under workers' compensation law when they refer the worker to another primary care physician for follow-up care. The physician would still be allowed to provide medical services for that worker for another 30 days and 12 visits, the same as any other non-attending physician in workers' compensation. And the -2 amendments allow that the emergency room physician could authorize time loss benefits, which is the wage replacement benefit, for a maximum of 14 days for a worker. If the worker needed time loss benefits for longer than that, which is not unusual if somebody's got emergency room care, they need to see another qualified attending physician to get that authorized under this bill. Turn my notes here. The last point I want to make is that a physician may treat patients in an emergency room, but there are physicians that also maintain office hours and who work in independent practices. I personally had the experience of being treated by an emergency room surgeon and then following up with him in his regular practice. And in those instances, the physician could be the worker's attending physician under the Dash 2 amendments, if the physician otherwise qualifies as an attending physician to provide follow-up care to the worker. And I'd be happy to answer any other questions.
All right, thank you. Questions, Senator Avakian?
Thank you for that explanation. It seems odd that we would allow the emergency physician to treat somebody for 30 days but not allow them to authorize time loss during that entire period of time. What's the reason for limiting the time loss to 14 but allowing continued treatment to 30?
Well, if they go back to see the emergency room physician, that emergency room physician can then become the attending physician, and then they can authorize it for, as I understand, for as, you know, as long as necessary, as long as medically necessary.
And my understanding of the real intent of this bill is that if the emergency room physician basically is going to see the worker one time, and typically just have a broad authorization for time loss where they put in a note, you know, workers off work or worker should be on time loss or something like that. The intent is on those claims to limit the amount of time loss that an attending room physician can authorize when they only treat the worker a single time. Non-attending physicians, however, in workers' compensation do have authority to continue to provide treatment for up to 30 days. So if in the instance that the worker could not find another attending physician to authorize time loss, they still can see that physician for treatment anyways. But that would be a very unusual circumstance, I think. Most people can access another physician.
I understand that. My question is, if we're going to, by law, allow them to see the emergency physician as a non-attending doctor for 30 days, which the statute, I think, clearly does, why do we limit the time loss to only half that period of time, 14? What's the rationale behind limiting time loss but allowing medical treatment for 30 days?
The way I understand it, the rationale is to basically provide a motivation for that emergency room physician to assure that they refer the worker either back to their primary care physician, or in the case where workers don't have a primary care physician, because that's not, unfortunately, not uncommon either, that they refer them to another physician who's going to take over care if that emergency room physician thinks that they're going to need time loss for longer than 14 days. In most cases, that's usually not going to be the case. So, I think I'm probably not being responsive to your question.
No, I think you answered. It seems to me, okay, the bigger motivation would be to say you can only give them medical services for 14 days. I don't understand why you say, okay, we know you're hurt, we'll treat you, but we're not going to let you get paid for your lost time from work. I don't see the rationale in allowing one but not the other. Follow me?
Yes. And I think the work group, if I may, Mr. Chair, I'm sorry.
Yeah, I just want to say what I'm hearing is basically it's 30-30 or 14-14.
I don't think so. I think it's 30-14.
Yeah, but I'm saying that what you're saying is that it makes sense.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah.
That it should be parallel. It should be the same. Is the question. And did AMILAC, was there any discussions on that?
Well, I think with the when it comes to the 30-day, that is what any non-attending physician can see a person. And I think to make it consistent with the rest of the law, you're in that regard. Is why it was deemed a 30 days, and I think the 12 visits, because that's the way any non-attending physician. I think that was the rationale. And truly, you know, emergency room physicians don't want to give ongoing care. I mean, that's not what they do. They are specialists in making sure someone's medically stat and moving them on to someone that can give them better care.
So let me follow up on a question on that, if I could, then sure. Come over here. So, if the emergency room physician sees them at the emergency room, determines that the person should not be basically working for 14 days, that's what this would allow them to do, mm-hmm. Then the hope is that that individual will then be referred either to their attending physician or whoever will become their attending physician, who could in fact be the emergency room provider if they have a private practice on the outside, and within that 14 days make another assessment, and then allowing them to have an additional 14, 16 days, or
whatever
they
need. Yes.
Okay. Yes, Senator Gordley and then Senator Monroe.
Question, are there any physician members on MLAC?
Mr. Chair, Senator Gordley, no, there is not.
Do you have, as the bill was being worked through, do you have any knowledge about any consultation that may have taken place with the medical community in looking at the way the language is written?
Mr. Chair, Senator Gordley, yes. I did have a brief conversation with Mr. Jim Anderson, who's the lobbyist for the emergency room physicians, and he did have some input into the bill, the Dash 2 amendments. So the lobbyist for the emergency room physicians was aware. I also had a conversation with the Oregon Medical Association lobbyist, and she was also aware of the bill.
Thank you.
Jim Monroe?
Yeah, let me, I think, Mr. Chair, I think you cleared this up in my mind, but let me just kind of put it on a personal basis. Okay, I'm a worker, I get hurt, I go to the ER. The ER doctor treats me and says, you're off work for 14 days. The ER doctor, at that point, if I have an attending physician, a regular doctor that I go to, I go see that doctor within that 14-day period, and that doctor makes a decision of whether or not I'm off work longer than 14 days. If I don't have a regular doctor, I can be referred to one by the emergency room, to somebody that ought to be treating this particular problem. Happened to me once. It wasn't a worker's thing, but I got a kidney stone, and they referred me to a guy that was a urinary specialist. Not a lot of fun. The other thing that could happen is if the ER doctor, if I don't have an attending physician, and the ER doctor has a private practice and would see me, I can go back to that ER doctor within that 14-day period. The ER doctor at that point becomes my attending physician and can extend the time I'm off work for however long is needed.
That's correct. And okay. Those instances happen more in rural hospitals, as we understand kind of what we had learned in this process, is that happens more in kind of the rural areas where you have a family physician that does a shift or two, you know, at the emergency room each week as well.
Okay. I think I understand it.
And I'll also make a point. You can, the injured worker can choose any doctor. I mean, not just whoever he is referred to, but they can choose anyone to be their attending physician. Just point of clarification.
Okay.
Senator Beyer?
Just a clarification. The 30-day is current law now for its attending or non-attending physician, and that includes people other than emergency room doctors, not just emergency room doctors. And I understand your point that they could have made them the same.
Yeah.
But that's current law, and under current law, non-attending physicians can't authorize any time loss. That's correct, isn't it?
Mr. Chair, Mr. Vice Chair, that's correct. And the original proposal from the proponents of the bill was for 3 days of time loss, and labor responded back and actually requested that they wanted more, that in this situation they felt like if a worker was seeking care in an emergency room, they might be quite injured and would need a few days to recuperate before even having to get up and around and chase down a doctor. So that was the thinking.
All right. Any other questions? All right. Chair is ready. First, I guess this is a public hearing. So if there's no other questions, gentlemen, thank you very much. Was there anyone else who wanted to give testimony on Senate Bill 504? Not seeing anyone jumping up wanting to come up here. We're going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 504. We're open a work session on Senate Bill 504. And the chair is willing to entertain a motion regarding the Dash 2 amendments.
Mr. Chair, I move the Dash 2 amendments in the Senate Bill 504.
Senator Beyer moves the Dash 2 amendments in Senate Bill 504. Discussion. I'm just going to put on the record, I think that this is appears to have been some type of quote-unquote compromise and worked out through the MLAC process. I think in respect to what Senator Avakian has brought up, I think it's something that we should be observing to see whether or not in future time There needs to be a correction to bring those dates more in order, but at this point it seems like it's more than what the current law provides for an emergency physician. So with that, I will be voting yes. Is there any other discussion? Any objection to the motion? So ordered.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 504 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Byer moves Senate Bill 504 as amended by the dash two amendments to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any further discussion? Senator Avakian.
I am going to support the bill, and I'm glad to see us moving in the right direction, but I want to briefly illustrate what I think the difficulty is, even though this step is being made. You can certainly have situations where somebody goes to the emergency room physician. They don't have private insurance, and so they don't have a family doctor that they can go to other than that. The claim has not been accepted, and so when the emergency doctor gives them a note saying, go see this doctor, the doctor doesn't have to see him. And so the person is stuck with that initial treatment with the emergency room physician. And if they're hurt bad enough that they need that 30 days of treatment, they go back in, they can't get the additional 14 days of time loss. And so this does not put the injured worker necessarily in a position where they're going to get made whole. The notion that they go back a second time and that automatically makes the emergency room doctor a treating physician under workers' comp law, I don't think is so. So that doesn't solve the problem. So I think there's more work to be done here, but it's a step in the right direction.
Thank you. Senator Byer.
Mr. Chair, thank you. And I just wanted to say that, you know, we just testified to that if they go back for a second visit to the emergency room doctor, they would become the treating physician. So I guess that's a point that you dispute, but that was just testified to by the MLAC experts. So,
all right.
Some other day.
All right. Any objection to the motion that's before us, which is basically to move this to the floor as amended with a due pass recommendation? Not seeing any. So ordered. And we'll close the work session on Senate Bill 504.
Carry that, may carry it.
And Senator Byer?
I'd be happy to.
Senator Byer is eager to carry this one, and so we'll sign him up. And we're going to open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 762. Ms. Braun?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. 762 removes the cap of $1,500 for medical-only temporary disability compensation for workers' compensation claims and instead ties the compensation to the inflation index. This has a -1 amendment, and the -1 amendment deletes reference to establishing the amount by rule, and instead DCBS will establish the amount by bulletin. And it changes the CPI, the Consumer Price Index, that's cited to medical care instead of for all consumer items in Portland to Salem, Oregon, Washington. And rounds the adjusted number to the nearest $100 and clarifies first adjustments are January 1st, 2008. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right, thank you. We have Greg Miller and John Tiltz. Why don't you come back up? That's the only two I have listed here at this time. Greg, we'll let you go first, and then John second.
Thank you, Chair Przanski. Members of the committee, my name is Greg Miller. I represent the Associated General Contractors Oregon Columbia chapter. We're a commercial construction trade association. We represent approximately 1,100 members in Oregon and Southwest Washington who employ approximately 54,000 employees in the state and in Southwest Washington. Here today to support Senate Bill 762 with the -1 amendments. This bill is a product of a bill that was passed last session. House Bill 3318 passed unanimously out of both chambers. As the bill was making its way through the process, late in the session in the Senate Committee on Rules, a comment was made by one of the committee members of this is a good bill, good for small business, but wouldn't it be great if we could index the amount that an employer can pay for non-disabling claims so that it's not necessary for you to come back every so many years to adjust that amount. The initial amount that the bill adjusted in 2005 had been set in 1987. That amount was $500, and the amount that we adjusted it to in 2005 brought it up to $1,500. Non-disabling claims are legitimate accidents that happen on a job site. It's a smashed thumb, it's a sprained wrist that occur from slip, trip, and falls, and they're just a reality on construction job sites. This bill gives an employer the ability to continues to give the employer the ability to pay for those claims out of pocket without the claim impacting their workers' comp experience rating. It's a good bill for small business, and we would appreciate your support with the bill with the -1 amendment.
Thank you, John.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, I'm John Schultz, Administrator of the Workers' Compensation Division, which is part of the Department of Consumer and Business Services. And I thought Greg did a very good job talking about the bill. I just add a couple of brief points. I want to clarify that the way this program works is that the insurer actually first pays for the medical services, and then it reimburses the employer. The employer has the option to reimburse the insurer for their payment. And I wanted to make sure you knew that, because these claims do get reported, and they're being watched in terms of frequency of claims, but the costs are actually paid for by the employer, and that helps keep their workers' compensation costs under control. And then lastly, the -1 amendments will require the director of my department to establish a threshold each year on the change in the medical service consumer price index. And the plan is to evaluate the change in the index and then adjust the threshold amount, rounding to the nearest $100. So we're starting out at $1,500. If the index went up high enough, we would go to the next $1,600 or $1,700, depending on where the index pointed us. And that amount will be published annually by bulletin prior to January 1st, so it gives the insurers enough time to plan for the change and accordingly program their computers to get ready for that. So I just wanted to add those two pieces, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Are there questions for either members on the panel? Gentlemen, thank you.
Thank you.
So anyone else who wanted to give testimony today on Senate Bill 762? Not, we'll close the public hearing on 762 and open a work session on 762.
Mr. Chair, I move the -1 amendments into Senate Bill 762.
Senator Beyer moves the -1 amendments into Senate Bill 762. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 762 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Beyer moves the Senate Bill 762 as amended by the -1 amendments to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. And
would you like me to carry that one also?
No, I think I'm going to share the wealth today. I'm just going to ask. I mean, does anyone else want to carry it?
Senator Monroe wants it.
All right, we'll give that one to Senator Monroe.
Okay.
Got to keep everyone active on this committee. But thank you, Senator Beyer. There'll probably be others. And we'll close the work session on
you get my yes
Senate Bill.
True.
All right. So if I could get the sign-up sheet for 248, I'm going to look to see how many people are scheduled for that one versus the 506. Use the prerogative of my chairship here. Oh, boy, what a tough decision. I was hoping I was going to be able to make this. All right, we're going with as planned. As it was done on the script here. We're open a public hearing on Senate Bill 248. And let's see. I don't know if you'll give us the opening. And then I have Roger Hennigan, I believe it is. Mr. Hennigan, why don't you go ahead and come on up. And Anna, go ahead and give us the
thing. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 248 has a -1 amendment that deletes all parts of it except the part that requires a written arbitration agreement between the employer and the employee to be entered in the time of the offer of employment or subsequent bona fide advancement. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Roger Hennigan. I'm a lawyer in private practice.
solo practitioner. The majority of my practice involves representation of employees. I have litigated a number of non-compete agreements in the courts of Oregon, and I have also dealt with non-compete agreements in drafting and negotiating and consultations with clients. I actively participated in the drafting of SB 248 because of concerns I have with the ORS 653.295 in its present status. And I'd like to talk just a minute about some situations that I have encountered. The primary concern that I had in becoming actively involved in drafting this bill was a situation where employees have had a job offer from an Oregon employer. They've given notice to their prior employer that they intend to quit to accept another job. In some instances, they have picked up their family, moved them to Oregon, purchased a home, and they show up for work on the first day or by court decision on the second or third day of their new job, and the employer says, we have a non-compete agreement for you to sign. Now, under the statute as it's now written, that non-compete agreement would be enforceable if they sign it, agree to it at that time, and they have no other reasonable choice or alternative available other than to walk away. And I'm sure that under the circumstances that I've just described, I'm sure you would realize that most people are not going to walk away from that job at that time, would not be financially capable of doing so. And if they lose that job for any reason, even in no fault of their own, the employer can hold them to a non-competition agreement and keep them from working in Oregon, possibly in the Pacific Northwest, for a competitor, depending upon how the non-compete agreement has been phrased. Frequently, I've encountered situations where employers say to the employee when they present the non-compete agreement, we want you to sign this, but you know, courts don't enforce these. They aren't worth the paper they're written on. And that's completely false in Oregon. In fact, in my experience, Oregon courts are more liberal about enforcing non-compete agreements than many other states are. You may be aware that California has prohibited non-compete agreements altogether. I've encountered situations where the employer said it's going to be enforced under Indiana law or Ohio law or Pennsylvania law, and it would not be enforceable under Indiana law or Ohio law or Pennsylvania law, but Oregon courts, under conflict of laws principle, the judge can choose to apply Oregon law because Oregon has the most contacts with the situation, and it's enforceable under Oregon law, and it is enforced. In fact, I learned of another situation just this morning where a female employee in a male-dominated industry working with an employer who has a rule that employees cannot have their hair colored or dyed is going to be discharged because her hair is colored, and with the non-compete agreement that she signed, her conclusion, not mine yet because I'm not fully aware of the details, but her conclusion is that she has to move to Canada to get a job in the same industry. I'm opposed to the amendment that's been proposed personally because I think that an employer should be required to tell an employee at the time that the job is offered, simply say, we offer you this job, but you'll have to sign a non-compete agreement. That way the employee, in considering the job offer, can make a choice one way or the other. Now, The bill as originally drafted also had a proposal that a non-compete agreement would not be enforceable if the employee was laid off at no fault of their own. I think that's a good measure. In my personal opinion, it's not quite as important as the other part of the bill. And I would suggest that you might consider, if you're going to leave the arbitration provision in, why not have arbitration agreements and non-compete agreements identified in the definition part of the bill or the statute, and then just treat them the same throughout the statute rather than in dividing it into two parts, one for arbitration agreements and one for non-compete agreements. But that would require another amendment, which is not before you at the current time. In any event, that basically has all that I had prepared to say today. If you have any questions, try to answer them.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Hannigan. First, let me ask if there's any questions. Don't see any. Thank you very much for your time. Mr. Craven, I understand that you wanted to give testimony on this. Let me just let you know what's happening. You can come on up. First of all, you didn't sign up on the original sheet, and so I think there may be penalty points because I was making the decision as to which of the last two bills get to go. And Mr. Douglas has had to wait for this, so you may want to be considering his response when he finds out that he had to wait because you got to go first. This bill here, 248, it's intended of the chair is not to move the bill today. It's actually going to be carried over till Monday. If you haven't heard, there's going to be a collapsing or merging of 248 with 616. And so I don't know if you want to put anything on the record now or if you want to wait until you see what comes into the merger. My understanding of the vehicle that will be used is 248 because it has a broader relating clause. So your choice.
Tiny little bit. Mr. Chair, Jim Craven, American Electronics Association, just very briefly. I didn't get signed up, so I got caught in the crunch, and once I got in my chair, I was afraid as I jumped up, I would lose my chair and be thrown out by the patrol officer. So I apologize for that. Very briefly, just to set the stage and prior to the Monday hearing, we had a good conversation, I thought, on this last week. Mr. Campbell was here from the Ader Wind firm, you may remember. We still continue to believe there's a problem in unintended consequences with the layoff part of this debate, of injecting the phrase layoff into law and some of the unintended consequences we talked about last week about actually employees getting into a more contentious relationship with their employer because of that clause. We do not object to the amendment, the Dash 1 amendment that we saw here today. We believe it's good business practice to ensure adequate notice when either a non-compete clause or an arbitration agreement is required. We would like to see it say something like prior to a final offer of employment being proffered, that makes sure the employee knows they're going to have to sign a non-compete. We think that's good practice and common practice, and we would be fine with changing that part of the law. So we're okay going down that road with the notice requirements. We continue to have a problem with the layoff component. And just finally, after our hearing last week, we had some, you remember, Mr. Nick Fish was here, Bill Campbell was here, we had a good conversation out in the hall. I think there is a lot of interest. We've been sort of playing around with these little niche parts of this debate. I think there are some people in Oregon, perhaps even Senator Avakian and others, who would like to have a longer, extended conversation about the role of non-competes in Oregon law. I think we're focusing on the separation, how you leave the job part, rather than what should be the good scope of non-competes and are simple geographic limitations appropriate. And I think there are some people that would be prepared to work on that. I don't know if we can get it done before Monday or maybe during this session, but I know Representative McPherson has an interest in that broader discussion, and we'd be willing to participate.
All right. Thank you very much. I'm going to go ahead and close the public hearing on Senate Bill 248 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 506. Mr. Douglas, I apologize that I had this lineup and looking at how many people we had, and I was going to let who had the least signed up go first. So I guess you and Mr. Cravens can have that discussion later. I have Linda Barno signed up for this bill. Anna, why don't you give us the overview? And I will ask as she's coming up, is there anyone else that wanted to give testimony? John, come on up, please. I didn't see your name.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 506 limits direct medical sequela to conditions diagnosed, submitted by injured worker, and accepted prior to the closure of a claim for purposes of determining permanent impairment in a worker's compensation claim. It has a -1 amendment. The -1 amendment clarifies that the injured workers retain the right to request acceptance of a new or admitted medical condition. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right. Thank you. Ms. Barnell?
Thank you, Senator. Senator Prozanski and members of the committee, my name is Linda Barno, and I'm co-chair of the Oregon Self-Insurers Association. For those that are may not know who we are employers that have the ability to self-insure our insurance on this. We take great pride in our workers' compensation programs, and we feel that we have a special association with our employees. This relationship is key to our productivity and to the longevity of our working environment in which they specialize. Keeping workers on the job, maintaining that good working atmosphere is essential to our self-insured program. During the previous year, our association looked at some factors that had been discussed in workers' compensation. And one of the issues that was discussed among the employers was the issue of direct medical sequela. The issue of direct medical sequela is an issue that only rises in a very confined period, and that's during a medical arbiter's report. This idea was presented at the Management Labor Advisory Committee. They had asked a work group to be put together to look at this item. The work group consisted of the Workers' Compensation Division, the Oregon Trial Lawyers Association, the Oregon Ombudsman, member of MLAC, and the Oregon Self-Insurers Association. And out of that discussion came the language that you see in your amendment to address the situation. Currently, when a claim is filed and accepted, a notice of acceptance is issued indicating what the accepted condition is. With that comes a lot of verbiage on the worker's rights and things to know. At the time of claim closure, another notice of acceptance is set in place, again outlining the procedure for what is accepted and what the rights the employee has to add a new or omitted claim. And they simply write in and say, I'd like to add this. We get that. We go to the doctor. Is this part of the claim? The doctor says yay or nay, and we process it at that. If at that time the claim is rated, and when it is rated, the worker has the right to ask for an arbiter's exam, which is an examination set up through the state. We have a physician that sees them one time, looks at the claim, and rates disability. And during that time, we have found that the arbiter can expand what the accepted part of the condition is and rate accordingly and issue an order rating PPD or permanent partial disability. At that point, it stops. The worker can't say whether they want to file the claim or not. The employer can't address the issues of that as already is set in motion at the time a claim is filed and throughout the claim. This has ended up with claims going from 5 to 10% disability, expanding it to 80% disability, and there's no way to question the arbiter as to how they came to that. There's no time for the treating physician to look at it and see if they agree. So we feel with the group that we put together, which was heavy with, like I say, the Oregon trial attorney, the ombudsman, we wanted to make sure we were protecting the employees also. We put together and came up with this language that we feel is a fix to this situation. The Oregon Self-Insurers Association hopes that you read this and support our bill, SB 506. Thank you.
Thank you. John?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Again, for the record, my name is John Schultz. I'm the administrator of the Workers' Compensation Division, which is part of the Department of Consumer and Business Services. Under current workers' compensation law, medical conditions that are direct results or direct result of a worker's accepted condition are called direct medical sequela. And as Linda pointed out, they're included when determining a worker's permanent impairment due to their work-related injury. The idea of direct medical sequela is perhaps best illustrated by a couple of examples, and I included some in my written testimony. I'll share one. Workers fairly commonly in the workers' compensation arena suffer from herniated or bulging discs in their low back. It's a pretty common diagnosis. And as a result of that diagnosis, in addition to the back pain and loss of range of motion in the back, they may also suffer loss of sensation and weakness in a lower limb, ankle, foot. It's fairly common. The insurer, in determining the impairment at claim closure, would almost always catch the disability in the back, but they also might include the leg and the foot in the award of permanent impairment because they're directly related to the accepted condition, which is the herniated disc, maybe a lumbar 5 and sacral 1 or something like that. Under the current law, direct medical sequela conditions are included whether or not the worker has requested the specific condition be accepted by the insurer. The only exception on this is if the condition is denied by the insurer or self-insured employer prior to the claim closure. So if they've denied the sequela, it's not included in the rating, and the worker then has the ability to litigate that as to litigate the denial. The denied conditions are not included in determination of permanent impairments in the system currently. SB 506 limits when direct medical sequela of an accepted condition are included in the determination of permanent impairment at claim closure under the bill. A condition to be considered a direct medical sequela, it needs to be diagnosed. The worker must request acceptance of the condition, and the insurer must accept or deny the condition. This will help workers and insurers better identify what conditions are in the mix for rating at the time of closure. But I also think it gets to an issue that Linda brought up, which is that new conditions come into the claim that the insurers have not had a chance to examine, to actually put through their compensability process. And that is, I think, probably the most important change that this bill brings. The Dash 1 amendments clarify that the workers retain their rights to file a claim for direct medical sequela as a new or omitted condition at any time during the claim, and the Workers' Compensation Management Labor Advisory Committee reviewed this bill and supported it with the Dash 1 amendments. I'd be happy to answer any questions that I can. Questions?
Let me ask one.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to help clarify a little bit what this means with respect to permanent disability, because it's very complicated stuff. If, for instance, a person is diagnosed with a back strain or a low back condition or something, and a strain is accepted, it's closed, the arbitrator awards some permanent disability. 2 months later, a disc shows up on an MRI. So the claimant puts in a condition for a disc, and the disc is accepted. Can the disc then be rated for permanent disability?
It goes through the same process. It's like a new or omitted medical sequela comes up when it comes up in the reconsideration process. So it just takes it through the same process that all requests are made for.
I'm not talking about reconsideration. I'm talking about the closure.
Right.
The claim is closed, and a permanent disability award is granted. It's not appealed, so it's final. Then later the disc comes up and a claim is made and it's accepted. Can they go through another closure process?
They go through the same process as closed, rated.
And Mr. Chair, my answer to that would be yes. Senator Buskin.
That's all I have. Thank you.
All right. Any other questions?
Very good.
All right. I'm going to close the public hearing and we're going to take a recess just for a second. Work session on Monday, so please carry this over till Monday, and we'll get that on the schedule. With that, is there anything else we need to do today?
No, Mr. Chair, that's it.
All right, we're going to go ahead and close the committee for today, and we do have a busy Monday, so hopefully we'll have a room at 3 o'clock as compared to yesterday, today, and we'll try to get through everything then. Thank you very much.
We're closed.